Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast.
Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts Amelia
and Beth.
And happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Happy Valentine's Day. A day of love, a day of chocolate, a day of just wishing all those happy, lovey-dovey people would just get a room somewhere. That's a grump this week, a complete grump.
What else is new? Womp womp. So Beth, what's going on? What's good?
Nothing. We got some fun stories this week about it's Valentine's Day, so we're sticking with the theme. I'd rather be ghosted.
Yes. I'd like to give a shout out to all of our listeners not in Massachusetts and not on the East Coast of the United States, because the weather here is awful. And have you been outside at all today, Beth?
Yes, I have to walk back and forth between the houses. I did it so, penguin style.
So Beth records in a house that's next to her house. And I had to drive a lot today, which was a nightmare. For those who don't know, it is slushing. Slush is coming from the sky. It is landing on the ground and immediately turning into ice. And it is crazy. And it is awful. And I hate the snow. And I want to be warm.
So for those of you that tuned in for a ghost hunting podcast, we'll try to limit the weather updates. There's just something about the weather. I'm like, it's just awful. And nobody wants, I think, to hear how awful weather is ever.
Sorry, would you like to start?
Sure. I'll get started. The first person that I want to talk about this week is Anne Powell. And this little tale comes to us from a city with one of my absolute favorite accents. But I'm not going to tell you where it is. I'm going to let Andy Bernard explain where this is from.
What you really want is more of a Savannah accent, which is more like molasses just sort of spilling out of your mouth.
Savannah, Georgia. I wish I could do a Savannah accent, because it always does. It just sounds like molasses and it's wonderful. Anyway, so we are going to be not coming from New England. We're actually coming from Georgia right now. And we're going to talk about Anne Powell. There are a couple of different versions of what happened with Anne Powell, but this is actually the story that I like the most, so I'm going to tell this one. In the early 1800s, the Industrial Revolution's underway, it was really common for wealthy American businessmen to do an early version of a mail-order bride, except in this version, it was more of an arranged marriage with a young woman, and you didn't get them by mail. They actually came by ship. So the businessman here in the U.S. would pay the bride-to-be's passage to sail to America, and then she would be his. Basically, he bought her.
Can I just make a little note that mail-order brides today don't come in the mail either?
That's okay.
They usually come by airplane.
No. In that time, they came by ship, and it would take, it could take up to 16 weeks to make the trip across the Atlantic. It was a very long trip, and especially if you were coming from England all the way south down to Georgia, it could take an extra couple of weeks. But that was basically the story of how Anne Powell came to leave her home in England and arrive in Savannah about 3 months later. What was unexpected about the journey was that Anne would meet a German sailor on the voyage, and she would fall desperately in love with him. And when she finally got to her hotel in Savannah, she made the decision to sleep the night, break it off with her arranged husband in the morning, and run away with her sailor. Now, she got that night's sleep, and she wakes up in the morning, and that's where everything sort of started to fall apart. Anne went and told her husband that she made a mistake. She was not going to marry him. There was a brief struggle. She broke free and ran to the river to tell her sailor that she was coming with him, except the sailor didn't want her. He laughed and he sent her away as he prepared to set sail. Anne made her way back to the hotel, distraught, not knowing what to do. And this is where I'm not exactly sure which version might be true, but I do like both of them. The next morning, her body is found on the ground outside her third floor hotel room. And she's dead. Obviously, it's her body. So there are two different theories. One is that Anne was so distraught that her beloved sailor would treat her so, especially now that she was pregnant. She had thrown herself from the balcony in a fit of heartbreak, and she died when she hit the ground three floors down. Now, I know that in 2022, three floors is probably a survivable fall, but I'm pretty sure there wasn't good medical care. So basically, if there was anything wrong with you, you were pretty much dead. The other version is that her husband-to-be, in a jealous rage, came into her room and helped her over the balcony. You know, a little push, a little shove, a little dead bride. And the reason that this story is actually as popular as it is because the husband-to-be never asked about what happened to her. He just disappeared.
That's suspicious.
That it's very suspicious. So that it's a fun story of how we come to have in the 1790 Inn and Restaurant a haunted room 204, which was the room that Anne Powell allegedly jumped from or was pushed from. So she hangs around in that room, and she's actually a pretty good-natured spirit. She likes to have some fun with guests. She'll do things like turn the lights on, turn them off. She'll go over and unplug things on you that you've got plugged into the wall. She likes to rearrange people's belongings. She rearranges the furniture. Sometimes she'll take somebody's things for a day or two, and then she returns them. And people say that when they're sleeping in bed, they'll feel the sheets on the bed get tugged by an unseen force. There are reports of people who are staying in the room that there's just a woman who starts sobbing out of nowhere. They can't see the woman, but they just hear these sobs.
I was going to ask about that. I'm like, what, just like standing in the corner?
No, there's just it's usually the sound is coming from the corners in the room, but they just hear these noises. And so there's a lot of activity there. It was featured on one of the ghost hunting shows, and apparently they left a little trinket behind. It's a monkey doll or something. And so the monkey doll has a little ball with it, and Anne will occasionally come in and play with kids with the monkey ball, or the ball that the monkey holds. She throws it off the mantle for the kids to catch.
Cool.
Yeah, very cool. So anyway, if you're going to stay at the 1790 Inn in Savannah, Georgia, ask to stay in room 204. You might encounter Anne. Also, don't go into the kitchen. There's an angry ghost in the kitchen there that they're pretty sure was an old African-American servant who was very involved in voodoo. And it does not like women in that kitchen, throws pans at them. It was a great story. Little like spice jars will throw, just does not like people there. And then there's another ghost there that hangs out in the dining room area. I think his name's Thaddeus. He likes to leave pennies for guests to find.
Cool.
So check out the dining room. Try to stay in room 204, but don't go in the kitchen. Ta-da! Anne Powell.
Cool. Good story. I'm going to suggest she was murdered too.
I feel like
when you're like, you know, involved in like basically buying people, like you just want a wife and you like don't want to know this person you're going to spend the rest of your life with, especially back then, like you really, it was like till that and you're just like cool with whatever, then just probably feel people are disposable.
Well, yeah. And, you know, businessmen types tend to be, you know, they're not going to be, you know, insulted in front of their friends. So that definitely wouldn't have been allowed to stand. No, no, no.
Yeah. Sad story. I also have a story about a sailor.
Ooh.
For my first story. Yeah.
Excellent. Is it a pirate or a sailor?
Sailor.
Awesome.
I bring to you tonight the story of Minnie Quay. So Minnie Quay was born way, way back in May of 1861 to James Quay and his wife, Mary Ann. She grew up with her family in the town of Forester on Lake Huron, halfway between Port Huron and the Tip of the Thumb. I first read the Tip of the Thumb and I thought it was just like funny Michigan speak, but it's actually this 103-mile water trail. And by it is this island called Turnip Island that juts up out of the water. And it looks like a giant turnip standing on the water. It's really cool.
I'm always amazed at how people name things.
Yeah, it's always goofy.
Yeah, like Turnip Island. Like, okay, turnip. That's what you thought of when you looked at that island.
Well, it's kind of cool when you look at it. I can see how it looks like a turnip. I had turnips for dinner. Turnips are a very underrated vegetable, but I digress. Minnie's family owned a tavern in Forrester, which was a little small town right on the lake. And during the time, ships would dock at the small town due to its booming lumber industry. The town now, not booming. It has about 40 residents that live there year round. And more people come in the summer, but not a ton. Back then, it had a little more, but you got to think like how much more, because this was in 1861. We're in Michigan. Michigan became a state. I looked this up in like, I think it was like 1837. So it hadn't even been a state that long. I don't know. But anyway, so Minnie was 14 and she ends up falling in love with a young sailor that worked on one of the ships that would make its way into town. However, everyone in her small town was not taken by the young man, and the rumors had flown around that he had a girl waiting for him in every port he stopped at. So Minnie's father outright forbade his daughter from having any contact with this man. He prevented her from even saying goodbye and seeing him off when his ship left the harbor. But she made it very, very clear to those around her that she had every intention of hatching a plan and sneaking off to see him next time he came into port. But she never got the chance to put her plan into action because he would never be coming back. In spring of 1876, the news hit the town of Forrester that the ship the sailor had been on got caught in a storm and sank to the bottom of Lake Huron.
Aww.
Yeah. Poor Minnie was devastated by the news. Not only had her true love died, but she never got to say goodbye. A few days later, on April 27th, 1876, she killed herself by going to the town pier and jumping off into the cold water, drowning herself. She was 1 month shy of turning 15.
Yeah? How old was this sailor?
I don't know. I kept trying to find it. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, that seems sketchy.
He was written as a young sailor in a lot of it. So I don't know. A 1876 newspaper article reported on the story, quote, "A young girl named Minnie Quay, about 15 years of age, committed suicide by throwing herself into the lake from Smith's Dock at Forrester one afternoon last week. She was seen in the act of jumping by her little brother, who was on shore. A quick alarm was given and men commenced at once to grapple for the body, but it was an hour before it was discovered. Her father is a mechanic in Smith Mill and is highly respected. No cause is assigned for this rash act." But there was a cause, Beth. And the cause was a broken heart.
Aw.
So Minnie is buried in the Forrester Cemetery overlooking Lake Huron. And legend says Minnie's ghost has been seen walking the shoreline. Her mournful cries of sorrow have been heard coming from the cemetery late at night as she waits for her sailor who will never come back. Here's where it gets really weird. Young women from Forrester claim that they see the apparition of Minnie calling them to the waters, as if inviting them to join her at the bottom. One girl even went as far as to drown herself after saying she had seen the ghost of Minnie drawing her to the water. Very spooky.
So how does one drown themselves?
I don't know. You just go underwater and you start breathing. I don't know.
But your body floats.
Yeah, and when you drink in all the water.
But you can't really like force your body to stay under there. When you pass out, you'll come up.
You could tie a rock around yourself.
I suppose, but that just always makes me think, like, how did people drown themselves?
I don't know. I'm not an expert in this field. But the author of the book Lost in Michigan is this guy, Mike Sonnenberg. And he said, and I quote, "After learning about the story of Minnie Quay, I decided I needed a photo to go along with the story. So I wanted to get a pic of the Lake Huron shoreline near Forrester. And I found a beautiful county park north of the town to take this pic. When I looked south along the shoreline, out to a point that protruded into the lake, I was shocked to see what looked like another person on the shoreline. After I looked through my camera, I saw that it was only a lone pine tree growing on the beach, but I wondered if that had been the spirit of Minnie waiting for her sailor to return."
That's sweet.
Yeah.
Very sweet. Folks, we just want to point out that if you are sad or hearing voices telling you to walk into the sea and you're considering suicide, please call for help. It's available. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. Please do not give in to the voices.
Agreed.
Life is long. And somebody told me once that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Yeah.
Life is long, kids. Just talk to somebody about it and keep breathing. Anyway, back to the show.
Okay, Beth, so what's your story?
So my second story this week is from my other favorite accent. I don't have somebody telling you where this is, so I'll just tell you. It's from Houston, Texas. I do love a good Texas accent. This is about Alina Wunsch. And I think it's German, W-U-N-S-C-H-E, and her boyfriend, fiance, Edward Stone. Okay, so this is in Times Square, just north of Houston, Texas. And that's time spelt like the herb, not like the one in New York. Yeah, I thought that was kind of fun. And it's in Spring, Texas. So that's about 30 miles north of Houston.
Yeah. Anyway,
so May 5th. 1929, we have this couple, Alina and Edward, and they are just a couple of lovebirds. They've been going out for a while. They're engaged to be married. You know, they're fairly progressive, but, you know, she stays at her parents' house and, you know, she's, I think, just about 20 years old. Okay. Edward's a slight bit older than that, but not too much. So here's what we know about the night in question. Edward and Alina had gone up to Times Spring, where Alina's parents live, for the weekend. They both lived down in Houston. They lived separately in Houston because they were not married yet, and this was still 1929. So typically, on Friday afternoons, Edward would pick her up from her job, and he would drive her the 30 miles up to her parents' house in Spring, Texas. They would drive up on Friday night. Saturday night, they would go out together and have a good time, and they would drive back to Houston on Sunday. So this particular weekend followed the same routine. They had gone out Saturday night dancing at a club. Alina was known to love dancing. Edward did not love dancing, but he did love watching the people dance and, you know, just being there and seeing people and being seen. She spent the night at her parents' house. And the next morning, early afternoon, Edward picks her up and they start their drive back to Houston. We know that they stopped at a bar and they grabbed a drink. And they drove over to a lover's lane on their way home, you know, just to do a little kissing.
Nice. Well,
here's what else we know. Edward was found the next morning, shot outside of his car. And Alina was a little ways up the road, shot in the back, off in the ditch. There were some arrests, but no one was ever indicted. No. And the murder was never solved. So it's just this open murder of these two people. That's it. So Alina really dug Times Square in Spring, Texas, and she hangs out at the gazebo. And apparently she's a very friendly ghost. People go by there and there's a ghost hunt that goes there on a regular basis. And they very often get contact from Alina. So here is what they have found out about the murder from Alina. They found out that from the time that Edward picked her up at her parents' house, he was very nervous about something. He kept looking around. He was checking everywhere. He wasn't making his usual chatter. And it was not normal that they would actually stop at a bar on the way home. They would usually just go home. So that was a little out of character. They know from Alina's ghost that Edward actually died first, that they shot Edward while Edward was in the process of begging them not to kill Alina. They are pretty sure from Alina's ghost that Alina jumped out of the car after Edward was shot. And as she was running away, they gunned her down. So it wasn't like she got, that was the progression of events according to Alina. According to her ghost, Edward knew the killer, but she did not. So it was apparently whatever Edward had been nervous about all day was this killer. There was also a second man there at the murder that neither one of them knew who he was. So if you go by Spring, Texas, you can hook up. There's a couple of ghost tours that go around right in the city square there. You can go by and you can try to talk to Alina, or you can bring your own dowsing rods. She's really good with dowsing rods is what I got from my research. That's the best way to make contact with her, but she's friendly. You know, be nice to her. If you talk to her, don't, you know, be rude or yell things or demand things. Just have a conversation, right? And maybe you'll be the one to solve the mystery.
Good story, Beth.
Thanks, Amelia.
Is she known for having people yell at her?
No.
Oh.
That was just general ghost hunting etiquette. Just yell at the ghosts.
Okay. So my final story is a good one.
I would guarantee it.
True crime.
You don't ever tell bad stories on here.
I've told some mediocre ones. But this is a good one. I think I enjoyed reading all about this.
Okay.
So true crime meets hauntings. This is a story of the Strang Whipple case, aka the Cherry Hill Murders of Albany, New York. So the tale begins with Jesse Strang of Putnam County, New York, and he deserts his wife and children in the belief that his wife has been unfaithful. He becomes a drifter and ends up in Ohio, but around 1826 made his way back to New York and decided to seek a job in Albany. At the same time, there's socialite Elsie Whipple. Elsie is the daughter of Abraham Lansing and Elsie Van Rensselaer. She's also the wife of John Whipple. So Van Rensselaer, that name probably picks off a few bells with people, especially up in Albany. They are some of the richest people in the entire country in the United States at that time. And I believe someone in their family started Rensselaer University, which is also in that area.
I don't think it's a really common name. So I would assume it's that family starting the university.
Yeah. So these two collided when Jesse took a job as a handyman at Cherry Hill, the Van Rensselaer's beautiful Gregorian mansion. He took the job under the name Joseph Orton, which I believe had something to do with the fact he had abandoned his wife and child, but I'm not totally sure why he gave them a fake name. By all accounts, the two met and it was love at first sight, Beth. Jesse fell in love with Elsie. Elsie fell in love with Jesse. Everything's going well, except for the fact that Elsie is married. And actually, Jesse's probably legally married at this point, but I guess if you abandon everyone, it doesn't matter that much. So during this time, Elsie felt dominated and controlled by her husband. It is said that she tended to be overall grumpy person who is prone to hysterics and violent shouting fits. Her affair with Jesse was an exciting escape from her marriage. The lovers kept in touch with the help of members of the household who passed letters between them. This to me seems like a pretty bold thing to do. And I just assume that like the staff who worked there must have just liked Elsie a lot more than they liked her husband. Because like sending notes via other people, that's a bold move. So Elsie decided, as many married women do in the midst of an exciting new love affair, that the best thing to do would be to kill her husband, John, so her and Jesse can run away together.
If you're contemplating murdering someone else, don't do that.
Don't do that. Do you have a number for that one? Or
I don't know if there's a murder avoidance hotline, but maybe count to 10 at least.
Yeah. Count to 10. Do some meditation. Do some breathing work. Virgo's in retrograde. Everything's going nuts. Just give it a couple weeks. Jesse was reluctant co-conspirator, though. Probably because he had already successfully run away from a marriage once and no one had to die that time. But Elsie was dead set on putting her plan through. So at first, she tries to poison John's tea with some arsenic, but it didn't work. Meanwhile, John Whipple becomes very suspicious that something's going on with his wife, who you might remember was already known for those violent shouting outbursts. So he starts keeping a loaded gun on him. Fast forward now, we're in May 1827, and Elsie steals a bullet. Don't know where she got it, so don't ask me. Steals a bullet, gives it to Jesse, and starts insisting that he kill her husband. So Jesse climbs onto the roof of a shed one night and uses his $15 rifle, which Elsie bought for him, to shoot and kill Whipple through a window.
Okay, wait a second. So she buys him a gun.
Yes.
But for some reason has to steal a bullet.
It's very confusing. That's what I said. That's why I said, I don't know how this happened. So shoots him through the window, shot him in the shoulder. He falls over. He's dead. Jesse Strang then immediately ran towards a local store to secure an alibi for the police. So he runs to the store, right? He's like at the store. He's like, hey, I'm here. He runs back to the house and helps a doctor remove a bullet from Whipple's body. So this plan's worked, right? Well, not perfectly. You see, the police soon become quite suspicious and ruled that Jesse could have traveled the mile from Cherry Hill to the store as his alibi, and they detained him on suspicion of murder. Once arrested, a fearful Strang confessed to the murder and blamed Elsie for the conception of the plan in hopes of receiving a lighter sentence for himself. How's that for true love?
Yeah, the way to be a stand-up guy.
This led to the incarceration of Elsie. And whenever the two communicated through jail, Elsie would always remind him that if he hadn't confessed, they could have seen their plan through, running away to Montreal instead of being in that cold jail, awaiting what would become one of the most talked about trials of all time. Meanwhile, I'm like, why is she talking to this guy at all? Like, you guys could have been in Montreal. You're way past that girl. He just ratted you out.
Mm.
So believing Elsie would be given a lighter sentence as she was a woman, and because he really just wasn't a stand-up guy by any reach of the imagination, Jesse asked his lawyer, Calvin Pepper, to plant documents at Cherry Hill incriminating Elsie as the mastermind behind the whole plan. But Pepper refused to do this. And just as Jesse suspected, Elsie was made out to be a victim. Of course, the reality of the situation was, in fact, that she bought the rifle with her money. She removed the curtain to John's room so Jesse could shoot him. And she was the one who was trying to poison John's tea with the arsenic. So, you know, yeah. And you might be like, oh, well, this happened a long time ago. So, of course, they blamed the man and are like, oh, the woman's the victim. But if you feel that way, you can go right ahead and look up the Ken and Barbie Killers of Canada. This stuff still happens all the time. So the trial was wildly popular due to the social status of Elsie Whipple. The New York State House actually had to be turned into a courthouse for this event to fit all the spectators. So at Strang's trial, the district attorney was Edward Livingston, a relative of the Van Rensselaers, and the Langstons, who told Jesse to his face, you are guilty, you must be convicted, and you must die. The judge called him a serpent and a fiend. And when the judge asked the jury for a verdict...
Wait, not a serpent and a fiend?
A serpent and a fiend.
That's harsh.
So when the judge asked for a verdict, it took the jury 15 minutes before pronouncing him guilty of murder. So 3 days after Strang's trial, Elsie Whipple stood trial for aiding and abetting in the murder of her husband. And in 4 days, Elsie was pronounced not guilty and cleared of all charges. And once Jesse finished testifying on the stand at her trial, trying to get her in trouble, he was sentenced to death by hanging. So on August 24th, 1827, Jesse Strang was hanged in the last public hanging in Albany, New York. And it was probably the last public one because 30,000 people showed up to watch. That is a wild amount of people. Who knew that there were 30,000 people living around Albany at that time? So at first, Elsie continued to live in Cherry Hill, but then she moved and then she died 5 years later. So she moved pretty quick. So could it be she had moved quickly because this was a controversial trial and a lot of people thought she was responsible? And oh, by the way, she was responsible. Maybe. Or maybe it was because the ghost of her husband still haunts the property to this day. The Cherry Hill Mansion stayed within the Van Rensselaers family for generations, but in 1964 was bequeathed by Emily Rankin to the state of New York, who opened it up as a museum. People often see a ghostly man walking the halls and the grounds, and everyone seems to agree it is the ghost of John Whipple.
Look at that. So what's he do while he's there hanging around the museum now?
He just walks around. People just see him walking around.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Full body apparition just showing up out of nowhere. I love it.
Boop.
Yeah. And then just, you know, probably walks through a wall.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's it for our stories, Beth.
Yeah, that's it. Short stories this week, but excellent stories this week.
Yeah, I think they're pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any mail?
Nope.
Do we have any reviews?
Yes, we do have some reviews.
Oh, we have some.
We have some reviews.
Thanks for sending reviews, folks.
We have, I believe, 2 reviews I can read, and we have 7 reviews since the last time I read reviews that people did not leave any words to read. So thank you to those people, and thank you to these people. The first is titled "My Favorite Spooky Podcast," and this comes from BBFDHFBVDGIHDEYHFD. Always funny. I love to listen. Our next review.
That was a great review. Thanks. This is our favorite spooky podcast, too.
Our next review is titled Fun. And this is from Krisk520. Fun podcast that's not too scary. I've already listened to every episode. Well, thank you so much, Krisk520. That is very encouraging.
Amelia has listened to every episode, too.
About 3 times.
Well, thanks to everybody who sent in reviews or gave us a 5-star somewhere. We're on all the platforms now, aren't we?
We're on all of them. And now you can review podcasts on Spotify. So give us a 5-star on Spotify. You can also review us on Audible. We can get 15 stars on there. So that's extra fun. Ooh, that gives us like really nice vibes.
Oh boy, you got anything else for us, Beth?
When you're in a restaurant, don't let your kid hang over the booth and look at me. Please don't. It's okay to say hi. I'm friendly. I'll say hi. But if my food is there, let me be. That's all.
Has this happened to you recently?
Not recently, but it has happened to me.
Yeah, I got some stuff that's been annoying me too. When you're in a restaurant or anywhere in your life, don't ask women if they're pregnant. Just what is wrong with you? You don't do that. It's 2022. Stop. Maybe I've just been eating a lot of bagels and I don't need that feedback from you. Okay. Let's see. What else do we have here? Other things that have been of annoyance to me recently. Oh, when you're in a restaurant, don't move the tables around and then not move them back when you leave. Why does everyone do that? That's a weird one. If you're going to move it, like, first of all, you should be like, can I move this table? Which no one does. And then once you move the table, move it back to the right place. My goodness. Also, when you are in a restaurant, make sure it's a small business because we are struggling like crazy right now, especially if you're in the New England area. So be sure to go out, support your little mom and pop stores. We need it the most. Anything else, Beth?
Did you update the website?
I've been updating the website. Yeah.
Oh, aren't you industrious?
I am. I've been doing a lot of websites lately. Websites are my new thing. I have website in my eyeballs because my small business is really slow. So I've been doing a lot of website stuff. So yeah, our website's getting updated. So that's been a lot of fun. Oh, remember last week when we were like, what did we do in between the break?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mention I got a bird.
Oh yeah.
I got a really cool little bird and you can follow my really cool little bird on Instagram at Parakeet Pancake.
Parakeet, not Pancake Parakeet?
That was taken.
Really?
Yeah.
Pancake the Parakeet was already taken.
It was already taken. I guess someone else named their parakeet Pancake too.
Oh. Well, by all means, follow all of those accounts. If you're into parakeets named Pancake or parakeet shaped pancakes, I'm not. has Liddy accepted these new friends?
No, Liddy, my cat, actually, it's funny you should say that. So I was hanging out having some TV time with Pancake, my bird, and she was on my finger. And Liddy, the cat, came over and tried to eat her. And I was like, Liddy, you can't eat Pancake. She is your sister. And the cat then did not speak to me for 2 days. And that is a true story.
Amelia's cat is tough. Her cat doesn't like anybody. She only likes Amelia. So it's if she's not liking Amelia, she's really in a lonely place.
And that's it. That's about all I got. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Happy Valentine's Day, Beth.
Happy Valentine's Day, Amelia.
Thanks.
I hope nobody sends you overpriced roses. but instead thinks long and hard about what you would actually like as a person for a small token gift for Valentine's Day. Although this is your first wife Valentine's. So
I was going to say, well, if someone knew me, they would know I don't like anything small. I like big gifts and overpriced roses.
Yeah. Oh,
and my name's Amelia Rose. I love roses.
My name's Beth Ellen. I don't love Ellen's.
I love roses. I love all flowers, but I extra love roses.
Also, if my boss hears this, Ellen, I actually do like you a lot. My boss's name is Ellen.
Womp womp. So okay, Beth, you got anything else?
If you want to contact us out, I am all good with that.
All right. So you can find us online at ghosthuntinginnewengland.com, facebook.com/ghosthuntinginnewengland, on Twitter, ghosthuntingne, follow us on Instagram at ghosthuntinginnewengland, send us an email, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, or a carrier pigeon. Just tell them, go to Pancake's house. They'll know. Birds can talk. And as always,
happy hunting.